You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, April 2nd, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, folks.
Welcome back, Jay. You took a couple of weeks off.
Yes, I did, unfortunately.
Yeah, sad news against everyone's very sorry about Michael. I know he's a really, really close friend of yours.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning it on the show. There was no way I could record the show the past couple of weeks. It took me a while to get my feet underneath me. I mean, this is just the way that it is. You know, bottom line is, it just doesn't really matter how old you are. It's just devastating to lose someone that you're close to. And I absolutely loved him and thought he was just one of the best people I had ever met in my life. And on top of that, you know, he was an avid skeptic and a very intelligent guy, very into the community. He did a lot of stuff for the SGU.
Talented as hell.
You know, I just found it's just very difficult. You know, I don't have any religion to soften this blow. I don't have any way. It's just a big, hard razor blade. You know, there's just nothing between me and it. And it's really hard.
Jay, I thought it was easy to be an atheist. I thought it was a cop out. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact hard. That I have no morality, yeah. You know, helps a little bit, but,
yeah. Yeah. You cashed in all your feelings when you gave up God when you were eight, you know?
Well, that's what that guy from Duck Dynasty thinks, right? If you're an atheist, hey, rape is okay, murder's okay, everything's okay.
Oh, God, did you hear that? Like, seriously, that was so, I actually was insulted from hearing that.
hundreds of millions of Americans were insulted right with you.
So we're recording the show on April 2nd, just so we don't have to record on April 1st.
Yeah, we're superstitious though.
Although,
the jokes would have been endless. I mean, come on.
There is a movement to make April 1st Skeptics Day, which I think is among skeptics. No, it's true. We can convert April Fool's Day into You Should Be More Skeptical Day, basically. Why not?
Well, yeah. I'm all for that.
We could hijack it.
Turn it into something useful. Yeah.
All I think of when April 1st rolls around, I always go back to the horrible prank that Steve and his wife Joss played on all of us.
Oh, gosh.
And Perry got totally lit up, pissed off.
Oh.
The basic idea was that Steve was going to live out his life as a doctor where? In D.C., Steve?
Yeah, I pretended like I was getting a job after residency. I was offered a job in D.C. and I was going to move down there. It's totally plausible.
It was because that's where Joss's family is from, that area, you know. And I just remember thinking, like, I was so angry at you, like Steve's going to move away. I'm never going to see him again. You know, that's it. I'll see him at Christmas.
I made a fake letter from the hospital that hired me.
Yeah. Oh, you.
But the person that it affected the most was Perry. And he got so pissed at you, Steve. He was talking crap about you behind your back the whole time.
He never forgave me.
He
did not forgive you. That's awesome.
Well, that was my one big April Fool's prank. I got it out of my system and I never did it again.
That's awesome.
It still resonates.
Well, plus you'd never let me get away with it again. I mean, I shot my wad on that one. There was a really funny SGU involved April Fool's thing. Bob, you sent that to me. What was it?
This was a post written by Terry Simpson, and it was Simpson a link to an article, and the name of the article was Food Babe to Join Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Dr. Terry Simpson. And I just saw that and broke out laughing. And he basically described how we hired her to be on the show and we had recorded an episode. And it was just, it was my favorite April Fool's joke this year. And he did a real good job of it. The comments were funny. And hopefully there wasn't too many people that even entertained the possibility of that happening, even for a nanosecond.
Yeah.
But it was still, even though it was obvious to some or most, it was still very funny. Well done, Terry.
Well played.
Although I'd love to have her on the show.
Yeah, we have an open invitation for the food babe to come on the SGU. So we can have a very polite and respectful chat about her ideas about food and oxygen and things like that. All right, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
Yes, this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I will be covering Sandra Faber, who is currently a professor of astronomy and physics and she has made many scientific advances in her ongoing career, including the co-discovery of the Great Attractor. Ever hear of her?
No.
She discovered
the Raquel
attractor?
Welch?
Oh, yeah. Nice one. Okay. So Faber was born in 1944 in the great city of Boston, Massachusetts.
That's all I got to chuckle.
She received her bachelor's degree in physics and a PhD in astronomy. Two awesome degrees, if I were going to get a couple. She has definitely had an interesting career. Many, many interesting little highlights. She found an interesting relationship between the brightness of galaxies and the velocity of stars within them. I didn't know there was a relationship like that.
Oh, yeah. They're second cousins once removed.
It's called the Faber-Jackson relation. She demonstrated how important dark matter halos are around galaxies for their evolution. And these halos were, I think they were totally unknown just even a short while ago. So that was interesting. Also, she was in on the design of one of the best telescopes on the planet, the famous Keck telescope in Hawaii.
I like that one.
But my favorite, though, was the discovery of the Great Attractor. Now, for years, it was a mystery why the Milky Way was moving towards the constellation Centaurus at about 1.4 million miles per hour. They weren't sure why this was happening. She worked with a team of astronomers called the Seven Samurai, which is a cool little nickname. Okay. She and her team noticed a flow of galaxies over hundreds of millions of light years, a huge span of space, and they determined that it must be due to a huge source of mass that's obscured by all the gas and dust of the Milky Way. So even though it was very far away, our galaxy was right in the way of it, so we really couldn't see it in visible light at all. All the gas and dust was blocking it, so much so that it's actually called the zone of avoidance.
What?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. That's from Planet of the Apes.
No, that wasn't at the radiation.
It was the forbidden zone.
Forbidden zone.
Same idea.
They realized that there was some huge mass there, so they dubbed it, they dubbed that gravity well the Great Attractor, which is a really good name. They realized they needed something really pithy. So this then led to the discovery of the Norma supercluster at the center of the Great Attractor once they were able, you know, to have powerful enough X-ray telescopes to really see what was there and pierce the gas and dust. The Norma supercluster was initially estimated to have a mass of many, many billions of suns. Now, they've downgraded the mass a bit, but clearly this is quite a big supercluster. And like many discoveries in science, and especially really good science, this led other scientists to yet even more discoveries about this. And what they found more recently is that an even greater supercluster, much farther away, I think 500 million light years away beyond the Great Attractor, was another supercluster. This is called the Shapley supercluster. And this thing is big. We're talking about 10 quadrillion solar masses, according to a couple of sources I read. Just imagine 10 quadrillion solar masses. It's actually the most massive gravitationally bound object in the visible universe. So guys, remember Sandy Faber? Mention her to your friends. Maybe when discussing the comparisons of galactic peculiar motion to density maps from IRAS.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Evan, you're going to tell us about strange radio signals from space.
The final frontier. Indeed. Hey, did you guys know that since 2001? Did you guys know that since 2001, astronomers have been analyzing a series of radio wave emissions called fast radio bursts, or FRBs, which emanate from outside of our galaxy, and astronomers have detected a pattern. A pattern which, according to the data, leaves open a plausible case for extragalactical intelligence.
What?
That galactical?
How could that not be
really
all over the news?
Whoa. It was in the news this week. That's why we're talking about it. And it was picked up by quite a few places online.
Yeah, but just right out of the gate, I'm going to tell you, I don't think those are aliens, right?
Okay.
But go ahead.
What's the skinny, man?
I'll put it in a sort of context for you. We all know the movie Contact.
Mm-hmm.
But if you haven't seen Contact or read the book was authored by Carl Sagan. If you haven't seen the movie or read the book, I have two words for you. Spoiler alert. In Contact, a SETI scientist discovers an alien signal being carried over radio waves. The alien's beacon is a series of pulses and sets of numbers, starting with 2, ending with 101. They're all the prime numbers in that set. And of course, only creatures that could work with mathematics could generate such a signal.
Yes.
Since 2001, not the movie, but the year, since 2001, there have been 10 of these FRBs, these bursts. And according to New Scientist magazine, these bursts last just a few milliseconds, but they erupt with about as much energy as the sun releases in a month.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Oh, wow.
Boom. Well, that makes it a pretty good marker, I would say. It's not just some background noise or subtle changes. You know, these are like hits.
No, it's a thing. Definitely.
Yeah. Astronomers have been analyzing FRB data, and what they've determined is that the delay between the arrival of the first wave set of waves and the last set of waves of each of these bursts is always close to a multiple of 187.5. And this was confirmed in 2014 when the Parkes Telescope in New South Wales, Australia, caught a burst in action. And that's the first time astronomers have actually caught the burst in action. Others were found by sifting through data after the bursts. So what does this mean? Delay between the arrival of the waves? Well, although these bursts are extremely short in duration, they still have a front end and a back end to them. The front wave hits you, obviously, first, before the back wave does. The high-frequency portion of the wave arrives ahead of the low-frequency portion of the wave. And there's that time difference. This is called dispersion measure. And each burst has a dispersion measurement that is a multiple of the number 187.5. And if you line it all up on a graph, like they did for us at New Scientist Online, you'll see it makes a very pretty picture of a rather straight diagonal line. And analysts put about a 5 in 10,000 probability that this lineup is a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
But as you alluded to earlier, Steve, there are people who are sort of skeptical of the idea that this is somehow alien intelligence. There is a lot of other things to be considered. This is not proof.
It's a general rule. We find something that has some kind of mathematical regularity to it, you know, a radio signal. And then that has to either, if it's not coincidence, once we rule out coincidence, that there really is some mathematical pattern there, then either the mathematical pattern is a deliberate intelligence signal, or it represents some fundamental physical property. So if you remember LGMs, right? Little green men.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're the mathematical precision was just the timing of the pulses. You know, the pulses were coming at extreme regularity, but it, you know, eventually, yeah, we discovered those were pulsars. They were rotating neutron stars that happened to be aiming their radio waves at us. In this case, yeah. So if we accept the premise that the regularity, the multiples of 187.5, is real and not artifactual, then we need to figure out what the natural phenomenon is that is producing that mathematical pattern. Hard to prove a negative, right? It's hard to prove that there isn't some underlying physical cause for that, only that we don't know what one would be. We don't know what it is. You know, it's not really positive evidence that it is an alien or intelligent.
Of course not.
It's just intriguing until we figure out what the end. I mean, it's also intriguing if it is a new physical property because that's new, right? It's something cool. Either way, it's a win-win.
I find the remote concept, you know, idea that this could be aliens, it's so provocative. Like, I just love imagining, like, these other creatures that have some completely different way of thinking and of existing, right? You know, they're not going to be humans, of course. They're going to be some other kind of life form. Oh, my God. That moment when humanity, if humanity ever meets an alien species, that has got to be and forever will be the most profound moment of all time.
Now, Evan, is there any significance to 187.5, or that just happens to be the interval?
Just happens to be the interval. I didn't see any other significance regarding that number. Did you read something?
No. I mean, you can't say whether it could equally, in my eyes, be a natural, you know, the result of natural processes or some, or maybe there's some weird, you know, mathematical relationship. But, yeah. You know, you could always find some sort of weird mathematical relationship, right? I mean, that's what numerology is all about. So even if they did find, you know, if you multiply these three prime numbers and divide by pi, so what? I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
It's like Bode's Law, like we discussed last week.
Yeah, it does have those aspects to it. Certainly other things that we've talked about on the show that, you know, we're pattern-seeking creatures, so we're looking to make any kind of order out of chaos that we possibly can, and this is sort of just maybe another means of doing that.
But yeah, until we figured it out, and figure it out. It is a candidate signal. I think for me, the big argument against it being alien is how freaking powerful it is.
Now, I don't know, guys. What kind of power are we talking about here?
Well, a month of the output of our sun. That's huge.
All right.
That's amazing.
Compared to other things that we know about in the universe, where does that fit on that scale? That I don't know. I don't know how to compare it on a universal scale.
I mean, that's not a deal killer for me, Steve. It makes it more likely that it's a natural object, but hey, I mean, all you need is a civilization, 1,000 years more advanced than us? And that's not so crazy to think that, you know? But if it was something that was truly, beyond that, like a gamma ray burst type of thing, that would be, a little bit tougher to swallow. But yeah, that would be cool. Imagine if they could, marshal those energies. But yeah, I mean, I think it's still unlikely and, still keep my fingers crossed.
It'll be interesting either way. We're going to discover something new about the universe.
Yeah, true.
Science in action. Yeah. Yep.
Now, if we discover yet another one and it's still at that interval of 187.5, I mean, every time that happens, the probability that it's real goes way, way, way up, It's something cool. All right. I'm going to just discuss a couple of items this week, but first a very, very quick one. There's been a very interesting peer review scandal, which is sucky. Biomed Central, which is a UK company that publishes 277 peer-reviewed journals, announced that it is retracting 43 articles because of fabricated peer review, not fabricated data, but fabricated peer review.
That is terrible.
Yeah. Anything like this is always awful. Obviously science requires transparency and honesty, and anything that interferes with that is just always terrible to deal with. It reduces confidence in the whole system. But, at least the system polices itself, and this sort of thing comes to light. So what they found was that people were essentially peer reviewing their own articles. Peer review is when you submit an article to a peer reviewed journal, the editors take a look at it. If they think it's promising, they'll select, two or three people from the same field and, experts in the field, send it to them to anonymously pore over the paper and make sure that it's up to snuff, right? That its conclusions flow from the data, that it's references all of the appropriate, studies, that it's, it didn't make any factual or statistical errors. I mean, they're really supposed to vet it up and down. But you could put your thumb on the scale, but if your article goes to one of your colleagues, one of your friends, peer reviews your own article. Or, hey, if you peer review it yourself, what's better than that? So that's just a way of subverting the process and getting what would otherwise be substandard articles through the process. So that's what they discovered. Stuff like that. Stuff that's subverting the whole point of peer review. It turns out that most of the articles they uncovered were from China.
Oh boy.
Interesting. Why China, Steve?
Well, we don't know. I mean, they're investigating. They're investigating. Now the Biomed Central said this is not a quote unquote China problem, that they get a lot of robust research from China. They think that it's a peer review problem that just happens to have clustered in China, but whatever. I think they're being a little politically correct there, perhaps. Sure, there's lots of good research coming out of China, but, that's where this cluster of this particular type of fraud was coming from this time. We'll keep an eye on this story, see if anything else comes from it. Hopefully it's just an isolated case of unethical behavior, and Biomed Central did the right thing by just retracting the papers, coming out with it, saying, this is the problem, we're going to fix it. That's what they have to do. No cover up, no minimization. Just say, yep, there's a problem. We're going to correct it as best we can. Jay, I understand that despite what you might think, that the world is actually getting more green over time.
Well, that's what was misleading about the title, but that's not the case. But let me give you the full
picture
here. All right,
strain us out.
So a collection of scientists from many organizations contributed to a recent study of the global vegetation biomass, more accurately, they were looking at how much carbon is out there. They took 20 years of satellite data and charted the changes in carbon levels. And the scientists found that there has been a significant increase in vegetation since 2003. Now, the main locations are in China due to tree replanting, the regrowth of forests in former Soviet states, and more growth in tropical savannas and shrublands in Australia, Africa, and South America due to higher rainfall as of late. This equates to 4 billion tons of carbon stored in these new plants, which on the surface you would say that's awesome, right? You know, we were able to sequester 4 billion tons in this new plant growth. Things are looking good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's – unfortunately, that's not the whole picture here. So let me go sideways a little bit, give you some other information that will help you really understand what's going on here. So carbon dioxide makes up about 0.03% of our atmosphere. And there's a significant carbon exchange between, you know, the air, the ocean, and the land as temperatures change and as seasons come and go and everything. Now, carbon dioxide is a very, very small percentage of our atmosphere, but it is the main gas in regards to climate change. And the more plants that exist, the better, right? Because plants store carbon. So during photosynthesis, during this process, light energy is converted into chemical energy, and that is later used to feed the plants, as an example.
Yeah, so the bottom line is that there is a carbon system. You know, the carbon's moving around, but there's a finite amount of carbon in the environment, in the carbon cycle, as they call it. Of course, we're burning fossil fuels. We're releasing more carbon into the carbon cycle.
Exactly, right? So chemical energy is stored in carbohydrate molecules like sugars, right? So maple syrup, as an example. Delicious, right? Which is made from the synthesis of carbon dioxide and water. So in most cases, oxygen is the byproduct or the exhaust of this process. So how awesome is nature to give off oxygen as a byproduct of that chemical reaction?
And love without, you, nature.
Yeah, right. It's just really cool. Like when you think about like a lot of the chemical reactions that humans are involved in. So photosynthesis is still the source of organic compounds and most of the energy required for life. That's why we're here, you know, or that's why life grew to the degree that it did on this planet.
Or you could say that's why we have the kind of life that we have.
That is a more accurate way to put it. Carbon is locked inside the plants, and the more plants we have, the more carbon is taken out of the atmosphere. So that's why we like this when we see a 4 billion tons of carbon being stored in new plant growth. That's a good thing. Yai Liu, the study's lead author and a scientist at the University of New South Wales, said that 4 billion tons of newly trapped carbon is nothing compared to the 60 billion tons of carbon that were released during the same time period from burning fossil fuels, as Steve said. And oddly, and I've never heard this before, cement production.
Yeah, I didn't hear that one before either. That's a significant release of carbon into the atmosphere.
Wow.
So is tilling the soil, by the way. When you till the soil, you release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and how about your compost? You know, is that bad?
No, well, and anything that is – that's why it's carbon neutral if it's just moving it around the cycle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we want to keep as much of it sequestered as possible.
Yeah.
You know what
locking
I mean?
It.
So even if the total amount of carbon isn't changing, if more of it's in plants than in the atmosphere, that will reduce how much is in the atmosphere at any given time. But that carbon is not permanent. It'll move around. Again, the problem with fossil fuels is that we're taking previously permanently stored carbon under the ground and releasing it back into the carbon cycle where
all over the planet. Yeah, like just pumping it out. So the problem is that even these small gains that this news item points out can be wiped out really fast from shifting weather and further climate change. And this is, you know, I guess more of like a snow day in March. You know, it doesn't really mean that much. Scientists say that this growth was expected because the world is warmer and wetter due to climate change. And as the ice melts and the temperatures go up even a little bit, the tree line moves north. So more plant growth, you know, replacing, frozen land, and rising CO2 in the atmosphere is a precursor to vegetation growth. That's just the way that it works. And they call that the CO2 fertilization effect.
Mm-hmm.
So not that this needs to be said, but, you know, we of course need to stop pumping CO2 into the atmosphere and stop cutting down our existing, you know, large caches of vegetation.
They're supposed to be replenishing it, I think. Aren't there laws in place saying that if you take down so much, you have to replenish so much? And in some countries, there are those sorts of regulations.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, the big problem is countries that are home to our tropical rainforests. That's where a lot of our vegetation is. All right, Bob, I understand that if I really wanted to, I could get from here to the other side of the world in 38 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty much my entire opener right there, Steve. you guys have heard about the gravity tunnel. Steve, I know you and I have talked about this multiple times, but for years it's been known that if you jump down a hole through the entire Earth, you would pop out and come to rest on the other side in 42 minutes.
But would you survive it, Bob? Would you survive that?
Wait a minute. Not in the slightest.
Well, let's say if the tunnel were environmentally controlled. Let's just do a thought experiment. So, if it were kept cool and you didn't hit the sides, you're just falling straight down through a tube. Yeah, you would survive. You'd be in free fall for some amount of time. As long as something grabs you at the other end.
No, you would have to be in an air-free
a vacuum.
Yes, that is the assumption, because the air resistance would fuck all this up. So the assumption is nowhere.
And we're suspending gravity at some point here too. Right?
No, this is taking gravity into account. That's the whole point.
Really? So
yeah.
You pass through the center of the Earth and you keep going despite gravity pulling back you towards the center.
Well, yeah, but you would. That's the point. If you eliminate wind resistance, you would go up exactly as far as you drop down, right?
It's like a pendulum. Imagine a pendulum. You know, it's the same thing.
Pendulum, I get.
It's the same thing. This is a pendulum.
Same thing. It's all gravity. A pendulum swings because of gravity, right? I mean, it's the same damn thing. That's why, that's why it stops on its way up and heads back down.
You would clear the surface on the other side before the swing pulls you back.
Well, if the heights were the same, yeah.
Or however you leaped in is how you would come out. If you jumped up in the air 5 feet and then fell, that's exactly how high. But let me finish, guys.
Okay.
Apparently this problem is still brought up in physics classes, and you're asked to basically imagine a tunnel with no air, like we said, connecting the opposite sides of the planet, like London and the Antipodes Islands, for example. And like we said, there's engineering problems. Forget about those. We're talking 3 million atmospheres at the core and 6,000 degrees. That's gone. Just don't even worry about that, because that's part of the thought experiment. But regardless, even though you've got all these caveats, still the answer can be instructive and interesting. If you look at the equation that they used to use that came up with 42 minutes, it would reveal the following. That gravity would accelerate you, unhindered by air friction, of course, mm-hmm. to about 29,000 kilometers per hour or 18,000 miles per hour. So you are flying clearly much faster than terminal velocity when you jump out of a plane, which is like about 120 miles an hour. So gravity would then start slowing you down after you pass the core, since it would be only at that time that the majority of Earth's mass would be increasingly behind you. If you could stop in the middle of the Earth, you would be weightless, right? Because gravity is essentially pulling you the same in every direction. And you don't feel the force of gravity. So any direction you go is up. So, but then you would stop your deceleration and you would hang momentarily in the air for just a moment, just outside the tunnel on the exact opposite side of the planet. And this
step off at that
point. And it's 42 minute trip. And that's what everyone has been saying for years. And
I learned that in high school. It was 42
right.
minutes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is going back decades, many decades, Steve. So, I mean, just imagine that for a second, getting on the other side of the planet in 42 minutes. That's faster than the International Space Station can do half an orbit. You would be – guess how fast you would have to be flying to do that in a jet. What Mach?
25.
I
guessed it.
Holy shit. Did you read my post today?
No, I guessed. I just guessed.
Yeah, you nailed it. 25,000
miles to go around.
It's Mach 25. So that is one hell of a fast – jet. So one of the benefits of contemplating this scenario is, like I said, it could help you teach physics principles. And that's why they bring it up today. You could learn about simple harmonic motion, like a weight bouncing on a spring or the pendulum that I mentioned. So now the new bit here is Canadian scientist Alexander Klotz has been thinking about this. He published it in the American Journal of Physics. And if you look at the previous calculations, they assumed a uniform density of the Earth, right? I've read it compared to like a billiard ball. It's a uniform density. That's implicit in how 42 minutes is derived. But actually, that's not really how the Earth is, right? So Klotz used seismic data from what's called the preliminary reference Earth model to determine that the Earth, the exact change in density of the interior of the Earth, which goes from the surface, 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter, to at the core, 13,000 kilograms per cubic meter. So it's a big, big density difference that the equation never took into account. Now, also, the seismic data tells you that there's a big jump in density near the outer core, which kind of makes sense that density would go up so fast at the core. So if you plug this information, you plug these numbers into the new, more realistic equation, it showed a result of 38 minutes and 11 seconds compared to the usual 42 minutes and 12 seconds. So that's the bottom line of what he did. Now, surprisingly, this is an interesting aside. Surprisingly, it was noticed that if you perform this calculation while you ignore the seismic data, and essentially what you're doing is just you assume the force of gravity is constant throughout the trip. Just assume it always pulls the same and it's not slowly decreasing like the 42-minute one tells you. You would end up with a trip time of exactly 38 minutes. So only 11 seconds off of the new result. So making a very, very simple assumption, you get an almost perfect answer, which is really interesting. So basically the very simple assumption of a constant force during the fall, yields a better answer than the original similarly simple assumption of uniform density Earth, like the billiard ball. So you're trading one simple assumption with another and you're more accurate. And the reason why that works so well is surprisingly because the real world increasing of density of the Earth actually keeps the force of gravity fairly constant while you're falling. So if you jump in that tunnel, the force of gravity you will feel when you're 20 feet below the Earth, surface of the Earth, is pretty much the same as when you're 10 miles below it.
Yeah. So it's not a coincidence. It actually makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
It makes sense. Now you could say that, once you get into the core though, that the density changes so much that the gravitational pull on you is weakening fast, but that doesn't really matter because you're going 18,000 miles an hour. So you're whipping through that core so fast that it doesn't really affect.
Yeah. The amount of time you spend there, the entire trip time, is minimal. Yeah.
Right. So the end result then is that the constant force assumption results in an answer very close to the 38 minutes and 11 seconds. So finally, it's often been said, and Steve, I bet you're thinking this, that when you're falling down a tunnel, it doesn't matter how long the tunnel is. If you're going on the other side of the Earth or if you're going only a quarter of the way around, it's still the same trip, 42 minutes, and that is true. And if you think about it, it makes sense why that would happen because you're not traveling as fast, but you have less distance to travel, and it kind of perfectly balances out. Now, this new information is telling us something a little bit different, that a shorter tunnel does balloon back up to 42 minutes. So the longest tunnel is 38 minutes. The shorter tunnels converge onto 42 minutes.
That's not right.
Yeah. And that's just it's not symmetrical like the 42-minute one is. And finally, Steve, tell me if you thought of this one. The shorter trip tunnels always made me think, well, how would that even work? Because if you're going down a tunnel that's kind of slicing through the one side of the Earth, then wouldn't gravity be pulling you towards one side of the wall?
Yes, but you're assuming that you are sliding with no friction. That's the thought experiment.
Okay. So there's another thing I have to suspend my disbelief about. Yeah, they would have to.
If you're on rails,
another assumption.
Yeah, frictionless rails.
Frictionless rails. I thought of that as well. That would do it as too. But so interesting. Not a major revolution, but just an interesting tweak to a very common equation and scenario that people have been talking about for decades.
And what do the hollow Earth theorists say about this thought experiment?
I sent them an email. They haven't replied yet.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Hey, wait. They replied. They just replied. They say, duh.
That's an entirely
different.
Very
hollow answer.
I say, oh, yeah. That's an entirely different set of assumptions. One more quick news item. You guys hear of compression clothing?
For what? For working out?
Is that a new line?
For weights?
For sports? For sports performance? For runners?
Yes.
And athletics?
Well, let me tell you what I heard about this. I remember talking to a buddy of mine at work. He was a power lifter, and he said that in powerlifting, what they would do is they would put on the tightest. It would take like two guys. It would take people to help you to get these things on, and it would be just so incredibly tight. And he said he was able, at least, to lift more because I'm not sure why. I would just have to guess that all the support that the garment is giving you actually helped him to lift more weight. So so this must be related to what you're talking about, Steve.
Yes, it is related. That's what we're talking about. So this is we've talked about the fact that sports. That athletes tend to be superstitious and
just a
little bit, and they tend to do things which may not actually have a dramatic physiological effect, but if it might have a mental effect, if they think it makes them perform better.
Right. They, like wearing magnets.
Yeah, like wearing magnets.
Among other
Remember
things.
The last Summer Olympics, I think, or might have even been the one before that where it really peaked, seeing all of the athletes with the different colored tape in different weird patterns over their body.
They're still
kinetic tape. Total bullshit. Just, there's just nothing to it whatsoever. So the question is there anything to compression clothing for athletic performance? What do you guys think?
Yes. I would guess yes, based on my anecdotal experience with a friend.
Yes. Yeah, so we all know about anecdotal experience and friend of a friend. Yes. So the answer is no. The answer
is
no.
It's really no. Yeah, okay. I'm actually not too surprised.
So there was a recent study looking at the effects of compression sleeves for calves on athletic performance, and there was no significant effect.
What kind of athletic performance? Are we talking purely cardiovascular?
No, it's also like running speed or, you know.
Well, I mean, yes, it's so for aerobic athletes, not anaerobic.
Well, I don't think that there's any particular indication for which it's been proven. And of course, you could always keep breaking it out saying, looking at increasingly smaller slices of the claim that haven't yet been specifically explored. But, I'm not saying it's impossible. It's something's happening. You know, it's doing something physical to the body. And, it certainly is possible that it has some vascular effects or muscular effects, whatever. As you said, Bob, I think your assumption was there's some biomechanical effect there. There's more support for the joints or whatever.
It just goes to show you all you skeptics out there, that this is one thing one guy told me literally 10 years ago, and I never researched it, but I always kind of assumed, yeah, it was plausible.
Just stuck in your head and something.
And stuck in my head, and I something that always felt that, yeah, that makes sense, and it probably does work. He seemed so sure about it. He had to be right.
Therefore.
In 2013, there was a systematic review of the studies that have been done so far looking at compression clothing and athletic performance. And they essentially concluded that while there may be a small effect, for example, in vertical jump height and mm-hmm. in short duration sprints, so in certain types of exercise, that the effects are essentially insignificant, if they exist. So
that's interesting you say that, Steve, about the vertical jump height, because when we've looked into other things like, mouth guards we've talked about before, that's the only area in which there may have been some statistical significance in any of the data. So it's very interesting, I think, that you bring that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the one that's most susceptible to just the placebo effect,
Mm-hmm.
Well, yep. Steve, I did notice you mentioned that there was a noticeable effect on the a high jump and the what was the second one?
I didn't say noticeable. There's a slight signal there, but it's not significant. Yeah, and there's still the possibility, the researchers mentioned, that there may be some help in recovery. It may help the muscles remove lactate, for example, but that's still not proven. That's just a possibility at this point. So, yeah, the thing is, if there were a big effect, there's enough research that we would be seeing it by now. It's always hard to rule out a progressively small effect. So this is probably one of those things that, yeah, maybe there's a tiny effect. There's nothing big, but it's mainly placebo effect. It's just athletes like to have something to do to think that they're getting an edge or they're improving their performance, but it's often not rigorously science-based. Well, guys, we're going to do another movie review this week. This time the movie is Going Clear, an HBO documentary on the Church of Scientology. What'd you guys think about this?
Oh boy.
It was very powerful. Yeah, I just thought, as far as documentaries go, it was extraordinarily provocative. I already knew quite a bit about Scientology. I just learned a lot though about L. Ron Hubbard, things I didn't know about his past. And then there was quite a bit of interesting activity over the past 5 years that I hadn't been completely fully read up on, which was a lot of the defections of people that are high up in the church. And, look, my quick summary is the movie's fantastic. I have nothing to say negative about anything about it. It was done wonderfully. It was very powerful. They had to pick what they talked about because there was probably so much to talk about. But mm-hmm. it's so impactful, guys. I can't believe how evil Scientology is. I didn't think it went down that bad.
It was two levels worse than I even imagined. Wow.
Exactly. Well put, Bob. Like, it just was way worse than I thought it was ever going to be.
Yeah, some stunning revelations, I think, that even those of us who have been familiar with this cult for quite a long time, decades, in fact, it came as sort of a stunning, unfortunate surprise to us that they're actually, you know, they threw people in the hole, basically, their own officers, these people who, you know, for whatever reason, felt that they were not compliant enough, shall we say, to put it nicely. So what do you get for that? Oh, I've been with the church for 17 years. Well, into the hole you go, and we'll feed you some gruel and live with the rats and go crazy until you want to, you know, do anything or say anything in order to get out of that sort of prison.
Well, the movie starts by going into the history of L. Ron Hubbard. You see quite a bit of footage of him, some unseen footage before this film came out. You know, I don't want to make personal judgments on him about his looks and everything. It's hard to not do it, though, because he was extraordinarily creepy. He just gave me right? Like, he just has a massive creep factor. And I found out things, the way that he treated his wife and his personal abuse of his wife. Mm-hmm. You know, you could just see the origins of the church in his psychosis or whatever was wrong with him, whatever he was trying to figure out in his life manifested itself in the church. That was mm-hmm. one of the interesting takeaways that I found out, like that he was essentially writing Dianetics, not as his treaty on mental health and how to live a life, but it was him dealing with his own mental issues.
I mean, he really was a piece of work, you know, by all accounts. Him, you know, he was very abusive. He was a megalomaniac, apparently. You know, he was very deliberate in what he did in terms of, you know, first he wanted to create a new branch of psychiatry. And when he got rejected for being a crank, he just said, okay, well, screw you guys. I want to make it into a religion and demonize psychiatry, you know.
And then, of course, there's the famous L. Ron Hubbard quote, you don't get rich writing science fiction. If you want to get rich, start a religion. Quote. Yeah.
And, you know, as the thread of the movie passes from the history of L. Ron Hubbard and his, you know, he was in the military and he was, you know, essentially kicked out for incredibly poor performance. And he lied about
incompetence.
Yeah, total incompetence. He lied about, you know, his record. And he was a very, very prolific science fiction writer. I mean, mm-hmm. I'll absolutely give him that. I think they said in the film that he had over 1,000 books published. Like he had been more published than anybody else.
Yeah. A lot of it pulp fiction, but yeah.
But still, you know, he put his time in. And then they slide it into, you know, passing the baton as the years go by and he dies and then Miscavige takes over. Then they get into that guy.
Oh, talk about, you're saying creep factor, Jay. That he gave me the creeps as well.
Yeah, he is extraordinarily creepy. And that guy has just been, L. Ron Hubbard was basically warming up the abuse. And this guy took the baton and he went absolutely apeshit with it. He, incredible abuse that he put down on everyone that he came in contact with. And talk about a control freak. Talk about, you know, a guy that is not doing any of the things that he's claiming, you know, bettering humanity is probably the last thing on his list. Just a mean, mindful, deliberate man that knows what he wants and doesn't care who he steps on or how he gets to wherever his goals are. I can't imagine that this religion, in the upper echelon of this religion, the people that are doing all of the horrible things that know the activity of the religion, the actual things that are going on and the hard decisions that they need to make and the horrible things that they do. I can't imagine any of those people deep down really believe they're doing good work, that they're doing work to help humanity. I mean, at that point, the ones that don't leave, that stay in there, I just think it's a collection of horribly demented people, you know? They're just horrible people that do horrible things and know of all the crimes that the church commits and they don't do anything about it. Just a sick organization from top to bottom. You know, it robs people throughout their lifetime in there. It fills their head full of a construct. Some of the members were saying, you know, the Scientology construct was so bankrupt. It's so bankrupt. It doesn't give you any real skills. All it does is draw you in with the cult, make you feel like you have a sense of community early on and that, you know, you have some type of like plan that you're on. But one guy was saying in the movie, it was so interesting. He was basically saying that every level above you lies to the level below them, saying how great it is to be at the level above them.
Oh, nice.
She was. Yeah. Basically, you've bought your way up to that point, you've invested, you know, a lot of your life, a lot of your, all your money at that point, and they've sucked you for all your physical resources by that point.
Yeah, it takes $200,000 to basically get to that point where you're at the top levels, and then you go through these 8 top levels that they have. And at level 3, that's when they give you the briefcase with all of the nonsense about the religion. And this
those are L. Ron Hubbard's handwritten notes that you get to see with your own eyes.
Yeah. Oh, really? You know, one of the defectors at that point thought, this is their test to see if you're crazy. If you buy this, then you're a nut job.
Oh. Yeah, Steve, you're talking about Paul Haggis.
Yeah, that's right.
I enjoyed his moments in the film the most. Incredibly sincere, intelligent guy that just looks right in the camera and says, I was stupid for believing in this. It was ridiculous. And he said once he finally did the research, because they make you not look at the internet. They tell you, don't read any criticisms about the church. Don't do this. Don't do that. And all these people do that. They follow those instructions. And Paul, at one point, he started to research things as he got tipped off. You know, something made him start to question, and he started to look, and then all of a sudden it was just a flood of information on the web that he exposed himself to, and the light bulb went on, and he just realized, oh my God. Now, 2 of his 3 daughters are gay, and the church is strictly anti-gay and thinks that L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics and his process is the only way to cure yourself of this and all that. And he is a human rights activist of sorts, and he, you know, very strongly believes in human rights and people's freedom to live their lives the way that they want to. And of course, you know, when you have a guy like Paul Haggis saying, my 2 children were not acceptable to the church, you know, that was a huge factor, I think, in his decision making as well. But I think he's a very honest and very likable guy that was not afraid to call BS on himself.
Have any of you guys read Neil deGrasse Tyson's comments on the movie?
No, what did he say?
So I have to preface this discussion by saying that I have mad respect for Neil. He's an excellent science communicator, but he has a blind spot here that is interestingly, the exact same blind spot that James Randi had. So 15 years ago, Perry and I had to educate James Randi on cults because he made the exact same mistake that Neil is making today. Hopefully I'll have an opportunity to talk to Neil and correct him in the same way.
So
he's writing this. This is for the Daily Beast. He was interviewed and he said, so you have people who are certain that a man in a robe transforms a cracker into the literal body of Jesus, saying that what goes on in Scientology is crazy. Let's realize this. What matters is not who says who's crazy. What matters is we live in a free country. You can believe whatever you want. Otherwise, it's not a free country. It's something else. And then later on, he says, religions, if you analyze them, who is to say that one religion is rational and another isn't? It looks like the older those thoughts have been around, the likelier it is to be declared a religion. If you've been around 1,000 years, you're a religion. And if you've been around 100 years, you're a cult. That's how people want to divide the kingdom. So the mistake that Neil deGrasse Tyson is making is that he's only considering belief systems according to the details of their beliefs. And if you're looking at it from that perspective, he's correct. There's no basis upon which to say that the beliefs of one faith are any more reasonable, rational, whatever, than the beliefs of another faith when you're talking about the miraculous, supernatural beliefs that different religions have. So, and yes, he's correct that, you know, the supernatural or miraculous beliefs of your own faith seem empowering or beautiful or whatever, while the same level of supernatural or miraculous beliefs in another faith seem crazy and weird, because that's just cultural. But he's missing the point entirely. The real difference between a religion and a cult is not the details of their belief. It is their behavior.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
What Scientology gets our attention because of their behavior. Yes, their beliefs are especially nutty because L. Ron Hubbard was a mediocre science fiction writer who wrote a science fiction, you know, cult. But it's the thing that this movie is about, Going Clear is about. And the reason that we pay attention to this as skeptics is because of their behavior. The fact that they do isolate people from their family. They isolate people from any disconfirming opinions or information. They attack their critics. I mean, and they attack them viciously. They took out a whole page ad in the New York Times attacking this movie, attacking all the people that defected from Scientology. They're now saying that they were kicked out because they were problems. But that's what they call anyone who disagrees with them is a problem, right? That's
when I walked away from Judaism when I was 13, none of those things happened to me. I was free to go. And, you know, frankly, I didn't suffer any repercussions of anything like that. But not with Scientology. You pay. Yeah. You pay for a long time. Once you're in, it's very hard to get out.
So Randy made the same observation at a cult awareness conference that Perry and I and he was at, and he later had
that go over.
He had to apologize after we explained to him why that was not the most astute observation to make. And then I wrote a full article in their newsletter discussing the demarcation line between religions and cults, because that was harder because there's a lot of religious people in cult awareness circles. But and it's just true too. It's like, yeah, you can believe whatever you want. That's not the point. The point is how you treat people. It's how you treat your members. It's how you behave. Scientology hides what they believe from their own members until you've given them $200,000 or whatever. So you've gotten all the way to the.
Oh, the members of Sea Org are in what, 40 cents an hour?
Wow.
The people in the front offices of Scientology?
Yeah, that was a very interesting point that they brought up, was that they're not being taxed. They're basically getting free labor, and they're getting massive donations. I mean, the church has massive real estate holdings globally. That's where they're putting all their money into, and it gives them a lot of political weight and power.
But the IRS caved to them and their fight for tax exemption. You know, shame on the IRS for
they fought them for a long time. But you know what? They're in the same boat in that it's not the government's job to say that one set of beliefs are worthy of tax exemptions and another set of beliefs aren't. So they're kind of in a tough position. But again, if they fall back on determining that by behavior, then they'd be on more solid footing. But still, it's still hard for the government to be in the business of this. I think the government shouldn't give any religion tax exemption. Why should they?
That would be
but
good.
If they're going to do it, then they're in this awful position where they can't really distinguish one from another, you know?
Ratings for this have come in. 1.7 million viewers watched Going Clear when it premiered. That's HBO's highest number of viewers since the 2006 Hurricane Katrina documentary directed by Spike Lee. So, look, hey, that's probably a million or more people who didn't know anything about the practices of Scientology who are now aware.
How does that compare to the South Park episode where they exposed the beliefs of Scientology?
It fell about 12 million short of the South Park numbers.
But again, South Park focused on beliefs while this movie focused on behavior, which makes it more devastating. All right. So watch the movie. I think that's my recommendation. Watch Going Clear. I think it's very, very enlightening. All right, Jay, you're 2 weeks behind on Who's That Noisy? We've missed it. Come on, get us caught up.
No guesses, huh, guys?
It sounds like something electronical.
Duh. Of course. That's something called Eurosignal. That was a European paging system. And it was in operation between 74 to 97. And, you know, I would imagine that everybody on the other side of the planet is going to recognize that one. And most people from the United States would have no idea what it was. But it was actually introduced in Germany in 74. And it moved to France a year later. And then it finally was in Switzerland in 1985. And it has a very similar internet protocol-y noise about it.
Yeah.
And I just found that to be interesting and also like one of those things where, you know, a lot of people do know about it, but a lot of people don't.
If you played the sound that a modem makes when it's connecting, like we would instantly recognize it.
Yeah, I'm sure people our age in Europe would recognize that sound very quickly.
Okay.
Cool. That's awesome.
Well, what do you got for this week?
All right, guys, so have a listen to this one. Is that cool? Evan, what is it? What is that?
Oh, I don't know, but it's loud and it's...
It's weird and pissed off.
Yeah, right?
Exciting. Or excitable.
I think you guys are going to love it when I tell you what this is and what... I'll give a tiny little hint. It is something that most of you are familiar with, used in a very unique way.
Very unique?
In a unique way. Excuse me. Sorry. I am a subject of my culture in a unique way.
All right. All right. Cool, Jake.
The most unique.
All right. Thanks. We are going to do a dumbest thing I heard this week. This is more of an entire article than one sentence, but this is from our old friend, Deepak Chopra.
Deecho to his friends.
Deecho. He published an article on CNN. An opinion piece. The title is Deepak Chopra, The Problem with Atheism. It's interesting because, you know, Deepak, if you read certain paragraphs in isolation, he actually sounds quite reasonable.
In isolation, out of context.
Yeah. One half sentence at a time.
So, for example, he writes, "We all fall somewhere on the sliding scale of belief and unbelief. Secular society has sharpened our demand for truth. To me, this is a positive development. If belief in God can't stand up to proof, it won't sustain a person through difficult times." You know, if I didn't tell you who wrote that and you read that in isolation, you know, yeah, okay.
Wouldn't think deep on, you know, that's for sure.
You would, you know, that's not bad. But then, of course, he's just setting you up, right?
Right.
He says, "I consider skepticism a way station on the way to a higher, more fulfilling kind of spirituality." Okay.
Sure you do.
What if you're skeptical of spirituality?
Then you're getting off at that
station. You're getting off at that station, yeah.
Next stop, reality.
Right. The sentence that I think where he goes off the rails. I mean, he's still laboring under, I think, these just straw men ideas of what atheism and skepticism are. For example, I feel for people who get stuck in any belief system, including rigid skepticism. They are signing up for the suppression of curiosity. That's the sentence that wins the dumbest thing I heard this week. As painful as it may be to question the faith you were brought up in, it's worse to be stuck. The human story is about growth and evolution. He's talked about people stuck in the religion they were born to. Meanwhile, he's an Indian who's promoting Indian religion. You know, he hasn't strayed too far from the religion of his culture. So, no, atheism is not about the suppression of curiosity. That's the thing that that's the drum he keeps beating, and he's been beating that for years, and it is simply not true. Skepticism and curiosity go hand in hand. They are two sides of the same coin. If you want to explore the universe and understand the universe and engage in science, as Carl Sagan said in the 1970s in Cosmos, right, to paraphrase, you need curiosity and skepticism both.
Both.
Yep.
Right? How many times have we heard that, Evan? Heard Sagan say that? I mean, Deepak is, hundreds. What does that make him, 40 years behind? We sorted this out 40 years ago, Deepak. This is not a new idea. Come on. How many times do we have to correct you on this point?
Get with the 70s. Yeah,
get with the 1970s.
That's not why he's saying it, Steve.
I know, but still, if you're intellectually honest, you know, then you should at least change what you say. You know, he's criticizing skeptics. He's not a skeptic. He's criticizing skeptics. If skeptics keep saying, "But that's not what we think," you're mischaracterizing our belief, and you just keep ignoring them, not answering the criticism, not altering your position, but just ignoring it. Then you're being intellectually dishonest. You know, what else is there to say? Your position is not worth taking seriously. If he wants to be taken, you know, he's probably beyond that too. But if you want your position to be taken seriously, you have to engage with the people that the intellectual tradition you're criticizing, right?
He writes things like this so that he can go back and say, or the people who support him can go back and say, "Oh no, wait! Deepak's really being the skeptical one here. He's the one who's bringing it up."
Oh God!
It's the people who are the hardcore skeptics who are running away from this idea and not wanting to confront Deepak about their rigid skepticism.
Yeah, which is kind of an oxymoron. You know, that's cynicism. Right. That's cynicism. It's not skepticism. Yeah. All right. Well, Deepak is hopeless. He's hopeless. Well, guys, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious.
Oh, God. Are
you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. A new study confirms the popular belief that batteries bounce higher when they are out of juice than when they are fresh. Item number two, engineers at NIST have created a, quote, nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator, unquote, which they claim could be used to fit an estimated 2.4 terabytes of data on an optical disk the size of a conventional CD.
What?
And item number three, researchers have taught blind rats to effectively see and remember how to navigate a maze by attaching a geomagnetic compass to their brain. All right, Jay, go first.
Okay, so this first one about the battery bouncing, they bounce higher when they're out of juice. And yes, I agree with that one. I think that is a fact. It's factual, Steve. If I go into the science behind this, you're not going to understand it, so I'm not going to bother explaining why. Just take my word for it. Okay,
thank you, Jay.
On to the second one. This one about the engineers at NIST, they created this nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator, which can't possibly be real because the name is so – like that's so what? Like 1950s type? Where would you date that?
That's the Martian?
Yes.
Bugs Bunny?
Yeah, the aluminum 200 space modulator or whatever thing he
– At last, after 2,000 years of work – the Illudium Q-36 Explosive Space Modulator.
Exactly. Modulator.
But the real thing here is the 2.4 terabytes of data on an optical disc. The size of a CD. Everybody says that. It's on the size of a CD.
Because that's the standard.
Yeah, I got you. All right. Well, okay. It sounds pretty, you know, retro badass, and I don't see why someone couldn't have figured out a way to do this. This one is they taught this blind rat to effectively see because he's basically using a magnet with his brain. With the brains. Yeah, but he's not, when you say quote unquote see, Steve.
For example, in the same exact way that you might say that a bat sees with his echolocation, right?
Yeah, the problem I have with this one is that I'm glad you brought up the bat because the bat has specific brain architecture to deal with, you know, putting together sound, so it turns it into, you know, some type of thing that it sees where it has a concept of distance and shape and all that. And to an animal like a mouse that doesn't have that built-in architecture in the brain,
a rat,
whatever, I don't see how they can, you know, do that. So I'm going to say that one's a fake.
Okay, Evan?
Batteries bounce higher when they are out of juice than when they are fresh. Do you guys ever hear that as a kid? I suppose I heard it at some point in my life. I don't recall ever sticking as far as, you know, a real thing in my brain or that I would ever really use that technique to confirm when my batteries are dead. Why would that happen, though? Why would it bounce higher when they're out of juice? I don't know enough about – we're talking about disposable
like
batteries,
AA batteries. Yeah,
double A's, 9 volts or whatever. I don't know enough about – the weight or how it changes upon being full of juice versus not. I suppose there could be a weight difference, though, and that could explain it. The next one about nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator. Okay, the bottom line is fitting an estimated 2.4 terabytes of data on an optical disc the size of a conventional CD. Where are we up
to now? As opposed to those unconventional CDs.
Remember jazz drives?
Steve, oh, yeah.
You were so excited when you got your first jazz drive in like 1997 or
yeah, whatever.
That is the coolest thing.
Well, I mean, we're
those are like 100
like
megabytes.
128
megabytes.
Yeah, it's like megs. Going from 1.4 meg to 100. It was a big leap.
But jazz drives, I mean, that went the way of Crystal Pepsi or something. And it was around for like 6 months and then nobody.
No, they were around for a couple years. They were.
Were they? I don't know. You're the only person I I ever knew who had one. So, but in any case, that's a lot, I suppose. I don't know. Don't have a good feeling about that one. The last one about blind rats effectively seeing, remembering how to navigate a maze by attaching a geomagnetic compass to their brain.
Come on, baby.
A geomagnetic compass. Gosh, I don't know about, where's the connection there? How something has to be connecting at that point. I'm kind of think I'm going to agree with Jay, and I think this one's the fiction. I don't know how that would link back up, how you could possibly, and get some sort of positive results in that they could use that information. Too far a stretch, I think. I think the rats one is fiction.
And Bob.
Ooh, let's see. All right, I'll start with three. Yeah, I'm kind of buying this one. I remember unrelated news items from a couple years ago that where people were able to get a sense of where they were completely outside of the conventional visual pathways. So this one doesn't surprise me as much as you might think. So, yeah, the other ones, though, yeah, some of these are wacky. So let's go over the nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator. That one, that's too awesome of a phrase for Steve to come up with, I think. I think that's a real thing.
It's called a backhanded compliment.
I mean, Steve. I couldn't even come up with that one. That's an awesome string of four words right there. I love it. I'm trying to parse the words and what they could possibly mean. Nanomechanical, sure, just very tiny elements. Plasmonic, I'm not sure how that's going to fit in. But phase modulator, sure, you're somehow manipulating the phase of the information that you're encoding. I can kind of make sense of that. And I just think that Steve would think that we would immediately try to shoot that one down just because of the word modulator. I think that's what he was thinking. The first one, I have no idea. It makes some sort of sense that the chemical difference between a charged battery and a regular and a discharged battery could have some impact on its stiffness in such a way that it would impact how it bounces. Sure, that's possible. But other than that, I have no idea. So wait, which one was I going to pick here? So, but yeah, even though it makes sense, the other ones make maybe a little bit more sense. So I'm going to say the battery is fiction.
Okay. So you all agree on number two. So we'll start there. Engineers at NIST have created a nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator, which they claim can be used to fit an estimated 2.4 terabytes of data on an optical disk.
And that's a nice jump. That's a nice jump.
Let me finish. The size of a conventional CD. You guys
That was a nice jump.
Think this one is science. Do you guys know what NIST stands for,
please? National Institute of Science and Technology.
And I haven't done that in a while. Sorry. This one is the fiction sweep.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, you
sweepity
this.
Sweep.
Oh, out damn. The broom, baby. Fuck.
You're right, Bob. I didn't make up the term. I just completely changed what it is. But I left the term the same because it's so cool. Come on. Nanomechanical plasmonic phase modulator is my favorite phrase.
Damn!
I love it. I know, me too, Steve.
I
knew about the batteries. I saw a demonstration.
All right, we'll get there. Hold on.
Hey, just saying.
So, okay, so this was, in fact, the article mentions Marvin the Martian.
Of course. You can't help but think of him.
Plasmonic phase modulator.
Marvin the Martian, right?
He was awesome.
All right, so, but it has nothing to do with CD technology or optical discs. What it is, though, it is computer related. This could be a way to get the best of both worlds between, you know, electronics and photonics. So, electrical, you know, the current computers, which are essentially, you know, commercial nanoscale electronics, we can make them very small, but there's a limit, an inherent limit in how fast information can travel through wires. Fiber optics have an advantage in that they can carry information 10,000 times faster than wires. However, they have an inherent limit in size because they can't be smaller than the wavelength, right? They have to be at least half the wavelength of the light that they're using. And so that creates limits in how small they can be. So they're bigger than conventional computer chips, for example, built on that technology. So they're faster but bigger. So it's part of one of the technological hurdles, you know, that we're trying to get over. So scientists have published some research that's kind of a proof of concept where they have using plasmons, which are far smaller than the wavelength of the original light that created them. They're almost like they're little like wavelets of electrons. The plasmons are free to travel down to nanoscale wires or gaps in metals, unlike light. So you can basically use plasmons and get the speed of light, but they can travel in wires. So you get the microscopic scale of current computers. That makes sense. So again, you're getting the kind of the size of the wire based chips with the speed of the photonic based chips in plasmonic phase modulation. And it's the phase modulation is part of the technology. Whenever you're using anything is modulating phases, what you're trying to manipulate there is the interference, right? If you get them to exactly line up, then you can cause constructive or destructive interference. And that's part of how they get the size of the waves down as small as they do. Totally cool. I completely made this stuff up about the CD technology, but while I was at it, I said, well, I wonder where we are with optical disc technology. And what do you guys think? Have you looked at this anytime recently?
No.
97 Jazz Drive.
I still think 2.4 terabytes is well above what is commercially available. There might be something in the lab that could maybe come close. But
so what's interesting is that we've lived through this. So this is like we all know this, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we had CDs, then DVDs, then Blu-rays. And this was essentially used for certain kinds of applications for like the desktop user. We would use this for archiving data, right? A DVD can hold 4 gigabytes of information. At the time, that was a lot. And so, I could burn a DVD and store all of my pictures on there and just archive them. So I know I have a permanent hard copy that will last for years and it's a good backup. Yeah.
10 years maybe though, but okay.
Not even more than 10, but still. So one option, especially when the price came down, you can get the more expensive disc that would last for 20 years or whatever. Right. So it was actually a nice little option there for a while. And also, computer games, usually came on DVDs, but in the last 10 years, everything has been moving away from optical discs. Cloud storage, thumb drives, solid state drives, and the disc capacities. We're still stuck with Blu-rays. So I've been looking at that. You can get a Blu-ray burner for a few $100s, and the Blu-ray discs, if you buy like a stack of 50 for like $55, so they cost a little bit more than $1 each, and they can hold 25 gigabytes. That's not bad, but 25 gigabytes. Yeah, I mean,
we have hard drives.
I know we have terabytes of data to back up, but 25 gigabytes at a time is just not worth it. All right. So there's two different technologies. So there's probably more, but I mean, I found two.
Holographic is one, right?
Yeah. So one is holographic versatile disc and
lame name.
Guess what they're up to, Bob?
A couple hundred gig.
6 terabytes.
Whoa.
Yeah, so this is theoretical. So, it all depends on the wavelength of light that they use and the number of layers that they use.
Right.
So,
right.
I think like right now, they could make ones with like 200 gigabytes or even 500 gigabytes. And then they're aiming for, they've been able to demonstrate, I think, 5 terabytes with a 3 micrometer on a 10 centimeter disc. So, this is what I'm reading. This is not available, obviously, on the market. This is just the technology. These companies, though, haven't been able to bring these to the market because I think that the market's just not there at the moment. And it's taking too long to, I guess, get them over the technological threshold. And you wonder, is there going to be a market for them? I mean, if I could buy an optical disc burner for under $1,000, and it could store 5 terabytes on a disk, and that disk costs less than $50. That would be a reasonable option for archiving,
Yeah.
For example, I'm just spitballing numbers, but these burners right now cost more like $15,000. You know, that's a little prohibitive. This is like, you know, like any of these technologies, they always cost many thousands of dollars until you're in the early adopter phase, or just only big businesses or whatever can use them. But eventually the price will come down to the consumer level. There's another technology they're calling the next gen Blu-ray, but Sony and Panasonic, they have a new 300 gigabyte disc, which again, they say that with multiple layers, and eventually they're hoping to get this technology up to 1 terabyte each.
Yeah. If it's rewritable, it'd be even better, but.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but so that's another technology that they're trying to get up to, 1 terabyte. Again, even when you get up to when you start talking about the number of terabytes, then we're talking. Yeah, that's
absolutely.
And then it's just a matter of price. And it just would be interesting if they come back, because I haven't burned a disk in so long. I mean, it doesn't fit any niche in my computer use anymore.
We don't really need it anymore. I mean, anything you want to transport, you can just push online.
Push online or buy a cheap thumb drive, right? Get a damn cheap,
exactly,
rewritable thumb
but
drive.
But if you could be burning 4 or 5 terabyte disks for permanent archival purposes, I would do that.
I would definitely do that. That's like, yeah. I mean, I don't have a drive bigger than a couple terabyte. I mean, that's my whole, my entire footprint. Bam, right on the one disk.
So anyway, that's cool. That sort of led me through the back door to revisit that whole issue of optical discs too. We'll keep an eye on that. All right. Researchers have taught blind rats to effectively see and remember how to navigate a maze by attaching a geomagnetic compass to their brains. That one is very cool science. And Jay, interestingly, you hit upon a core part of this research.
Of course I did.
And that is, it demonstrates how versatile and plastic mammalian brains are. The fact is, you could take a rat who's blind, and you can teach their brain how to use a completely novel type of sensory input.
Do you know the implications of that? I mean, we could be jacking all different types of sensory data into our brain, and our brain will be able to deal with it.
Yeah, Bob, you're interested in jacking off? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right, Bob?
Yeah, jacking in the brain and data.
So most importantly, though, guys, I was the closest to winning this week.
Yeah.
So really, really interesting. That's incredible. So they basically were, you know, these rats, right? I think, I don't know if the strain is blind, probably, but.
Right. And it's a visual cortex. So the visual cortex is actually taking completely different sensory data and making use of it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's incredible. That bodes so well, because that's one of the things in science fiction where you have people, you know, hooked up to their computer and taking in different types of information or sensory data.
Right.
And it's like, I always thought, well, I mean, I hope the brain could actually handle that, because, you know, you get a new flood of information like that into the brain, and it might not be able to handle it. And this looks like it can, which is great.
This is one of those things I've completely changed my mind about in the last 10 years, just based upon the data. I mean, 10 years ago, if you asked me, I think most neurologists at the time, or maybe 15 years ago, that how would the brain deal with novel inputs? And it's like, well, you know, if you're an infant, maybe, but if you're an adult, like, you know, could your brain control a third robotic arm? No, you don't have the cortex for it. Your cortex doesn't map to it. Could it see in things that you haven't seen before? It's like, no, you don't. Your brain has to map to its sensory and motor control. But that's
homunculus.
That's not true. Because the brain, I mean, it's true that's you have to have that at some point in time. But the point that what we've learned in the last 10, 15 years is that brain plasticity allows the brains of even adults to map to novel, both motor output and sensory input. Not only can we take new sensory input, there's right now the data is moving in the direction. The studies are starting to show that we may be able to interface with the matrix. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We may be able to occupy a virtual representation of ourselves in a computer simulation, and our brain will adopt that information. We may be able to, you know, take your head and put it on a robot and have it control the robot, you know, to have it map to the body of the robot. It seems like all those things are going to be possible. Or, you know, take a paraplegic or even a quadriplegic and give them prosthetics, and their brain can learn to use those prosthetics.
Right. Or give somebody, a healthy person, a third arm.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Bob, you're dying for that. Yeah.
Some people say
productivity goes up 50% with a third.
Or tail. How'd you like to have a prehensile tail? That'd be cool. Let's go back to number one. A new study confirms the popular belief that batteries bounce higher when they are out of juice than when they are fresh. That one is science. That's okay. One of those things you hear. Oh yeah, like it's a popular myth. You know, an old wives' tale type of thing.
Never heard it.
Yeah, but it turns out it's true. However, it's a little wrong. I mean, it's oversimplified. A dead battery bounces higher than a fresh battery, but a battery that bounces high isn't necessarily completely dead, right?
Okay.
What they did was they took 11 batteries and they dropped them down tubes, like plastic tubes, just so that the falling and the bouncing of the batteries will be controlled. You know, they wouldn't bounce all over the place.
Yeah.
They'll fall straight down and bounce straight back up. And they dropped them all at the same time. And then so that you could, and to the batteries were depleted progressively. So like on the left side is a fresh battery, on the far right side is a completely dead battery. And then in between, it's a spectrum, you know, of different amounts of drain. So essentially the video of the batteries dropping and then getting to their high point creates the graph. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The batteries give you that, you can imagine
that.
That's
cool. Yeah.
And what you find is that the batteries bounce higher and higher and higher as they get depleted, but about somewhere in the middle, it plateaus. So like when the battery's half dead, it's bouncing as high as it's going to bounce.
I see.
So if you have a high bouncing battery, it could still be half ready, you know, half full. It's not necessarily completely dead, but you may want to check it out. But the batteries that don't bounce at all are pretty close to being fresh. And of course, you know, you want to know, well, why is this true? And as you said, Bob, yeah, there's nothing magical about this. There's stuff is happening inside the battery that could change its physical properties. And so scientists have all these same scientists have discovered what's happening in there that does that, that as the battery gets depleted, that you get a layer of zinc, it says surrounds a brass core in the battery, like a donut around a hole. And essentially you get zinc oxide begins to form, and these zinc oxide molecules are like little springs. You can think of them that way. So instead of the energy of the impact getting spread diffusely through the battery, you get
absorbed and released.
It gets absorbed and released in these zinc oxide little springs. So it becomes bouncier and bouncier as you develop more and more zinc oxide. But that plateaus, you know.
Mm.
At some point, and then, you know, depleting the battery more doesn't make it bounce any significantly higher. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right.
Just, I didn't see it.
Well, good work, Steve.
It's a good, yeah, I liked all these items. I mean, I always am more interested in just how cool the items are, but I couldn't resist nanomechanical plasmonic phase.
That's what threw me. It was too good. It was just too fucking, too good.
Discombobulated us.
All right, Evan, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do. The quote this week was suggested by SGU listener Joseph Manone from Havertown, Pennsylvania. Thank you, Joseph. We appreciate this. Here it goes. Science is more than the mere description of events as they occur. It's an attempt to discover order, to show that certain events stand in lawful relations to other events. And that was said by American psychologist, behaviorist, author, inventor, social philosopher, B.F. Skinner.
Oh, really? B.F. Skinner.
One of the things he's well known for is the
Skinner box. Yeah. I call it a Monroe box.
I put a child in there, raise him like a wolf for 20 years. I think he'll have aggressions towards
My theory is he'll be abnormal when he grows up.
Not quite the same as, but a funny Simpsons take on that.
Yeah.
He's a bit controversial, huh?
In terms of his findings, they're not really generally accepted anymore, but.
Right, because he didn't take genetics and some other, you know, evolutionary psychology, some other things.
Hey, science progresses, you know.
But yeah, it does. And, you know, he was from another age, sort of. Oh, and did you know B.F. Skinner, the initials B.F., do you know what those stand for?
I do not want to hazard a guess.
Bob Frank.
I know, but BFF stands for.
B.F. Skinner, Burrus Frederick Skinner.
Thank you, Evan. So next week we will be at Nexus. There's still time to register. There's still plenty of seats available. You can register for the Friday Night Extravaganza with Bill Nye and George Robb. That is going to be a blast.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Can't wait.
You could do that by itself, or you could do it as part of going to the overall conference. Go to necss.org. Check out what we got. We'd love to see you there. Come to our table. We'll be meeting listeners and selling swag. It's going to be a lot of fun. And registration is open for the Amazing Meeting 2015, July 16th through 19th, 2015 at the Tropicana in Las Vegas. Go to amazingmeeting.com. There's a register now button. Click it. It'll take you to the registration page. The SGU will be there. We're going to be having our typical SGU dinner and doing a show live from the stage, and we'll have our table, and it's going to be a lot of fun as well. Just a lot hotter than Nexus.
Yeah, just a bit. Right. In the desert in July. But, I hear there's air conditioning.
There's air. So yeah, we'll you don't even know. You're in air conditioning the whole time. Well, guys, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.